about 7 past the hour. Okay, you can... There you go. Thank you. Thank you very much. You can cut the music. The governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, did it again today. Signed into law is a bill that bans schools from teaching classes designed for students of a particular ethnic group. School districts may appeal the law, which becomes effective December 31st. Now, what the bill is all about, it aims to ban ethnic studies in Arizona schools. When she signed it, it made a lot of right-wing critics who called such classes divisive. They were, you know, cheering. And others in the state of Arizona said it was yet another law targeting Latinos in that state. Now, this comes less than 20 days after Brewer signed an immigration bill that has caused widespread protests against Arizona. This bill bans schools from teaching classes that are designed for students of a particular ethnic group, or promotes resentment, or advocates ethnic solidarity. The bill also bans classes that promote the overthrow of the U.S. government. Only in Arizona would they have to have a law that bans classes that promote the overthrow of the government. The bill was written to target the Chicano or Mexican American Studies program in the Tucson school system. That's according to State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn, or Horny, H-U-R-N-E. Horny? Is it Horny? Tom Horny? I don't know. School districts that don't comply with the new law could have as much as 10% of their state funds withheld each, by God, month. The Tucson, Arizona Unified School District officials say the Chicano Studies classes benefit students and promote critical thinking. Judy Burns, the president of the district's governing board, said, quote, "We don't teach all those ugly things they think we're teaching," end quote. Judy, they don't think you're teaching any, they don't care what you're teaching. Arizona is falling off the continental shelf. Arizona is becoming the portal to some kind of education hell. Anyway, the president of the district's governing board in Tucson says she has no intention of ending the program, which offers courses from elementary school through high school in topics such as literature, history, and social justice, with an emphasis on Latino authors and history. About 3% of the school's 55,000 students are enrolled in these classes. Now, the other guy, Horny, or Horn, has been trying to end the program for years. He says it divides students by race. Oh, really? How could that be? And promotes resentments. He singled out one history book used in some classes entitled Occupied America, A History of Chicanos by Rodolfo Acuña, a professor and founder of the Chicano Studies Program at Cal State Northridge. Mr. Horney said last week in a telephone interview, quote, "To begin with, the title of the book implies to the kids that they live in Occupied America or Occupied Mexico or, I don't know, where else, Occupied Poland or Occupied Brooklyn." Also last week, Augustine Romero, director of student equity in the Tucson School District, said it now has become politically acceptable to attack Latinos in Arizona. This program is 14 years old, and it is offered in grades K through 12. What is Arizona trying to do? What the hell are they trying to do? In Tucson, the program is supported by a court-ordered desegregation budget as part of the district's initiative to create equal access for Latinos. Man, ethnic studies courses are sometimes controversial because people believe the programs are attempting to replace one voice with another. Yeah, well, that's how white people look at that, you know? White privilege, and this is what so many white people, I guess, are totally unaware of. White privilege, that's what's being challenged. White privilege and preference and dominance. We have been sending Molly to learn Spanish since she was, what, three? 3 years old? Anything that we can get our hands on for her. This book you've been reading her at night, part of it's in English, part of it's in Spanish, right? It's, what is it? Just stupid stories? What is it?
No, it's Skippy John Jones.
What the hell is a Skippy John Jones?
A kitty boy who wants to be a Chihuahua dude.
Is a kitty boy that wants to be a Chihuahua dude?
I love my white shoes. I love my white shoes. I love my white shoes.
I'm afraid to ask what a kitty boy is.
I'm sorry. Someone asked me the other day if I'd read any good books lately, and I said, well, I was really, truly enjoying Green Eggs and Ham.
Green Eggs and Ham, that's a good one, yeah.
Molly reads it to me now.
Anyway, the point is, anything, any way, shape, or possibility that a white family, a European-American family, can expose or open up their kid to ethnic studies, to foreign languages, to different histories, different cultures. I mean, I to me, that is an advantage that broadens a child. I mean, the last thing I want to do, and it's not just Molly. I think all my kids, they're all adults now except Molly. But they all have been exposed as much as I or their respective mothers have been able to expose them to different cultures, different races. And that's not, it's not because we're liberal. It's because we live on a planet where it's not all white people. We live in a country. We live in a state. We live in a neighborhood where it's not all white people. Jesus, God, what is wrong with the people in Arizona? What is wrong with this crazy goddamn governor? Excuse me, I didn't mean to say that. This crazy, I could think of another word, not the GD word, but this maybe, you know, this governor, what is wrong with her? What is up with this? No more ethnic studies. Teach him about white people. Calm down. We're only 15 minutes into the program. I don't get that. I would think that European American families, white people, would want their children exposed to foreign culture, different races, different ethnicities, different, histories, languages, the mythology that comes with different racial groups, or different ethnic groups. I tell Molly stories about elves and fairies, you know, which is strictly, well, what is that, Northern European. We also talk about a griot from Haiti, little teachers and wise people. We talk about anything that I can teach her on the level that she can understand. And, you know, I mean, she's only just under six, so it's not like a big deal here. But we talk about, you know, she's always trying to convince me that there really is a God. And I come back and explain to her that throughout history there have been many gods. And then we talk about the Greeks. She wants to know, well, what are you talking about? So I try to explain to her about Mount Olympus. I don't know if she knows who I'm talking about or not, but we'll be right back. Pretending day by day. We can go on. Pretending day by day. That's a no. Somewhere soon.
conservatives. Don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. We talked before about the most well-organized and biggest terrorist organization on the planet, and it has been for the past 50 or 60 years, and that would be the CIA. Yeah, even bigger than the KGB, even bigger than whatever group of monsters that Kim Jong Crazy has put together. But the CIA, and if you're a student of American history, you know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to go into it deeply tonight, but we've talked about the overthrow by the CIA of the freely elected government by the Iranian parliament of Mohammad Mossadegh back in 1953. He was the most popular person in that country at that time. And Bill Hare, writing it's posted to Op-Ed News, points out that the tragedy today in the Gulf involves the same BP that in 1953 used the CIA to overthrow Mohammad Mossadegh. And as Bill writes, the fact that Mossadegh was elected by the will of Iran's citizens did not deter the efforts of an invigorated CIA that used the Cold War as a pretext to move away from the fact-finding agency conceived of by President Harry Truman. That's what the CIA was supposed to be. And turning it into an aggressive international political body willing to overthrow nations in contravention of popular national will. But anyway, Mossadegh angered the international power cartel, of which BP was a primary player, with which the CIA was actively interlinked. You know, this power cartel after World War II. Well, you know, no need for a history lesson here. British Petroleum had been garnering the lion's share of profits from Iran's oil deposits. So when Mossadegh was elected by the Iranian parliament, he nationalized Iran's oil as a means of obtaining what he deemed to be a fair portion of the natural resource that belonged to Iran. The nationalization law was passed unanimously by the Iranian parliament. Despite the fact that BP was offered considerable compensation by Mossadegh, the prime minister's days were numbered after the nationalization bill was passed. Now, we've done this. The U.S. has done it. The CIA, the DIA, whatever. These alphabetical organizations. This is why the United States is seen as a fascist terrorist organization that tromps around the world, overthrowing governments we don't like, destabilizing currencies. I mean, look. Of course, we're not supposed to talk about this. If you talk about this stuff, you're not being a patriotic American. Oh, let's not have any truth. We don't want no stinking truth. Richard Helms, who would later become CIA director, was prepared to act with a close Iranian friend who became a political beneficiary. A plan was launched to overthrow the government of Mossadegh in a coup and hand over the reins of power to someone who would go along with the international power elite's interest on behalf of BP. And who was that? Well, of course, you know, it was Reza Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran. He was the one selected to take power by the CIA. This was determined by the CIA and Richard Helms. And with the successor to Mossadegh already selected, they overthrew his government. Now, the CIA's Middle East chief at the time was Kermit Roosevelt. He was the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, you know, the guy that decided to get involved in the Spanish-American War. The term blowback has been used with recent increasing frequency, and it certainly applied in this case. The Shah initiated a ruthless dictatorship in which Savak, Iran's secret police, was guilty of numerous human rights violations. Now, Savak was trained by the CIA and all sorts of methods of torture and police statism and so on and so forth. And eventually the Shah was overthrown by the forces of Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. And when the Iranian government demanded the return of the Shah to stand trial for murder and torture, President Jimmy Carter refused to extradite him because at the time he was dying of cancer. So this BP, these miserable bastards, you know, it just raises a question to me. Why do we, the people of the United States, or the government of the United States, why do we continue? The rest of the world knows this history because they have been the objects of our terrorism. They have been the victims of our terrorism. So they know full well what the United States has done. But people in this country, why are we not taught this? You see, why is it not pointed out that a freely elected government of Iran back in 1953 was overthrown at the request, more or less, of BP? BP kills Americans now. It made sure lots of Iranians died. It's made sure lots of people die all over the world. And everybody acts like, oh, BP, yeah, Beyond Petroleum. You know, they got the little flower. Ah, Christ. We'll be right back.
Your Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. Also at Op-Ed News today, posted there, Harvey Wasserman points out that as we die for BP, our military rots in the wrong gulf. The life of our bodies, nation, and planet is being blown out a corporate hole in the Gulf of Mexico and into a BP dead zone of no return. The apocalyptic gusher of oily poison pouring into the waters that gives us life can only be viewed or felt by each and every one of us as an ongoing death by a thousand cuts with no end in sight. Yet our government has done nothing to of significance to fight this mass murder, not one meaningful thing. As it did while New Orleans drowned, our most potentially effective counterforce dithers on the other side of the world, in the wrong gulf. And he's talking about our military. We squander our treasure on the largest conglomerate of people and weapons the world has ever seen. It's bloated with hardware designed specifically to destroy and kill. Hundreds of thousands of Americans sit on our dime in more than 100 countries, rotting and the outposts of a bygone empire. Those are our military people. Why aren't they in the Gulf of Mexico fighting for our truest national security? The depth and scope of this catastrophe is impossible to grasp because it is just beginning. The entire west coast of Florida, the entire Gulf, the Everglades, the east coast of Florida, all the way up, wherever the currents go, they're all at risk. This is the most lethal single attack on the life of this nation since December 7th, 1941. It's a time that will live only in infamy. The moment it happened, a sane president, a functioning government, a society worthy of survival, would have marshaled every mobile resource available and moved it down to the Gulf. Except by hitting a nuclear power plant and rendering this all radioactive, no terrorist could dream of igniting the kind of havoc now destroying our most vital resources. Our mass media should be filled with stirring images of a focused, determined president mobilizing all available assets to curb the damage. Instead, Barack Obama defends offshore drilling and endorses the resumption of whaling. Instead of seeing a Gulf population deputized and mobilized to fight for survival, we are subjected to a loathsome trio of corporate stooges blaming each other for the catastrophe. Thus far, the only armies officially mobilized are the corporate PR departments and the ubiquitous lawyers, savoring the gusher of billable hours sure to stretch through the decades. Yeah, we mentioned this the other night. You know, how come there is not just this massive response, not just on the part of the United States, but on the part of the rest of the world? Because if this thing is not stopped, they're going to feel it. Wasserman goes on, make no mistake, in our lifetime, the Gulf will not recover. There are no corners of the earth that we can pollute without poisoning it all and our own bodies. We cannot squander our resources on killing people on the other side of the earth while leaving ourselves to be destroyed by the mayhem at home. Either our species learns this lesson and acts on it now, or we do not survive. Wasserman is a senior advisor to Greenpeace USA and a senior editor at freepress.org, where this was first published. You know, I happened to see President Obama, and this arrogant little prick, Hamid Karzai. I mean, it's one thing to be the puppet. It's one thing to be put in power by the dying United States with the most powerful and out-of-control military in the history of the human race. But it's something else to, again, once you're put in power, to prove that you're just a 10-cent cheap little whore. No offense to sex workers, which is all Hamid Karzai is. What, his brother is one of the biggest opium dealers in Southeast Asia or South Asia. His brother also is on the payroll of the CIA. Hamid Karzai was a consultant to Unocal Oil. Here's a pop quiz for you. Somebody send me an email, especially if you're a conservative, if you're a Republican, okay? You dumb bunnies are great fun to play with. It's great fun to kick you in the ass and so on and so forth. But here's one for you. Why are we fighting in Afghanistan? Why do we have almost 100,000 troops in Afghanistan? Okay, I'll give you 10 minutes. Anybody got any ideas? I want you to email me. No phone call. Just email me. Just keep it simple. You know, KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. Just kiss an email. Send it in. Why are we in Afghanistan? Now, we could say the same thing about Iraq, but we know why we're in Iraq, because George Bush and Dick Cheney wanted to steal Iraq's assets, their oil. That's the only reason we went there at all. Steal it, not for the George Bush or Dick Cheney oil company, but for their friends, their cronies, Halliburton, KBR, all these filthy, degenerate corporations that are killing our country. But seriously, somebody email me. Why are we in Afghanistan? And it has to be your own thought. I mean, don't Google something. Just tell me. Tell me why we're there. This is from TBC. Oh, that would be Tom. Mike, I love your show, Tom in Portland. Greatly upset by the catastrophic oil spill. One thing that many listeners may not know is that, like Noam Chomsky said, the last liberal president was none other than Richard Nixon, who created the EPA, the Wilderness Protection Act, and hundreds of other hard-hitting environmental acts that were fought by big oil and corporations. And for this, he was removed from office. He was removed from office not by Watergate, but by an organized conspiracy, including such criminals as the Bush family, Cheney, etc. It is all covered in the classic book, Silent Coup. And as Eisenhower said, all the crazy oil men from Texas, Nixon was probably our last president to effectively stand up for the little guy and against corporate power. Of course, Nixon did bad things, but compared with who we have had lately, he is like St. Francis of Assisi. Well, he's right. Nixon, Nixon was also, he was mentally deranged. He was a megalomaniac of the highest order, delusional. He was a drunk. And we all know how bad that can be. He was responsible for the murder of, we'll never know how many people in Southeast Asia, including Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. He ramrodded some legislation through back here that corporate America hated him for. Now, you can make the argument that he was run out of Washington because of that, or that he was run out of Washington because he was a psychopathic murderer. Sharon writes, Michael, listening to a KPOJ Seattle, I'm so frustrated with this oil volcano that I really want to scream. Why is the government, the Coast Guard and Air Force, why isn't the government getting involved in this? Or no, she wants to know, why is the government? This is just the opposite of what we were just talking about. Why is the government, Coast Guard and Air Force, getting involved in this? This is not a U.S. problem, since these companies are not U.S. companies. Let the U.K., Dubai, and wherever foot the bill. This is a corporate screw-up, and they should not expect the U.S. government to get involved. Isn't that socialism? Cher, I think you're, a little delusional here yourself. Corporations, whether it's corporate America or corporate UK or corporate Dubai or corporate China, they don't give a damn about environmental disasters like this. They don't care. It's not in the capitalist handbook. What is in the capitalist handbook is loot, plunder, steal, destroy, murder, kill, exploit, enslave. That's in the corporate handbook. But there's nowhere in the corporate handbook that says, be just, be fair, leave your campsite cleaner when you leave than when you got there. Make sure if you give people lung cancer or ceilings down in the coal caves 8 miles below Earth collapse on them, you pay their families enough money to take care of them. That's not what corporate America or corporate anything is about, Sharon. It just isn't. So, of course, the U.S. government should be involved. Of course, the military should be involved. Absolutely. Nobody's going to help us here, Nobody, the corporations are doing nothing. This goddamn monster is erupting in the Gulf of Mexico for 3.5 weeks. What have corporations done? What has BP done? Nothing.
It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
All right. I asked people to send in why we're in Afghanistan. Here's one. To keep Christian rednecks employed. Another emailer says, poppies. We're in Afghanistan because of the Unocal pipeline. You know that, Mike. Another emailer. Afghanistan on the east, Iraq on the west, makes it pretty convenient for the war hawks to invade Iran. And this emailer, we are in Afghanistan in order to surround the most highly valued targets in the solar system. Oil fields of the Near East, which include Iraq, Arabia, Iran, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Armenia, the Armenia Caucasus, That is also exactly why we will stay in those countries until we find the right excuse to invade Iran and Pakistan. This is the setting of and the beginning of the great resource wars, which is the only real reason for us to maintain such an exaggeratedly powerful army in that part of the world. And this one, why are we in Afghanistan? For the corporate interests of a pipeline and for the war machine to profit. The people in Afghanistan want us out. They do not want democracy as we provide it, and they don't want that freak puppet running their so-called government. I cannot think of any other reason we are there. Obama calls it the good war. Good for what? Death and profit and a foothold on oil. And we are in Afghanistan because this nation would rather go bankrupt than admit we made a military mistake. Okay. I was hoping some right-wing half-wit would email in so I could laugh and giggle and hoot and holler at his or her asinine reasoning, but apparently that's not going to happen. That's cool. That's right. I would just assume you people go choke to death on a bologna sandwich anyway. Tom in Maryland, he wrote this at 6 a.m. today. Hey, Mike, I just got out of work. I work at a gas station, midnight shift. This morning, there was a mechanical problem with the pumps, which caused them all to shut off. The redneck attempting to fill his penis extension got angry. Guess who he blamed? Obama. That's right, Obama. This idiot looked at me and said, "It's Obama's fault trying to get the government in my gas tank." He was serious. I just looked at him with amazement. He seemed to want to say more, but I think my look of utter disbelief at his staggering ignorance and blind hatred shut his mouth. Sometimes I wish we had a bat behind the counter. to do what? Eat the mosquitoes? No, I understand. And another piece that caught my... by the way, we're going to have Uncle Mike's Story Corner next hour. And tonight's is by a famous author, famous linguist, Tim Klein, right? Saturday morning, I got a call from my friend in Boston, a zany PhD student finishing his studies at MIT. We recounted our lives since the last call, and conversation drifted to current events and the BP oil spill. We compared the physical damage from the spill to a terrorist attack. Quite suddenly, my friend asked, "What's the difference between British Petroleum and terrorists?" I thought for a moment. "Intent," I answered. "British Petroleum did not intend to spill gobs of oil into the Gulf. They care about people and would never maliciously hurt anyone. Or would they?" Long after I hung up the phone, I began thinking about the words a roommate had said while working at Valero, the largest oil refiner in the United States. The roommate said, "If there is one company bound to have another accident, it's BP. They have no regard for safety. They have a poor track record." This was in 2005. Down in Texas, a major explosion on March 23rd killed 15 workers and injured over 170 others. Since the accident, BP has paid $50 million in environmental fines, yet made over $80 billion in profit after taxes. What a great racket. Rape the earth and make obscene profits, but expect occasional disasters. Pay a penance. Repeat the process. Worried about your company's name? Hide dirty deeds in subsidiaries like Enron, or change the name altogether like Philip Morris to Altria. Americans will forget and forgive. Regarding BP, obviously another token fine is not enough. Imposing a strong carbon tax is the best way to deal with big oil, crippling its economic power over time. Tim Klein. See, I disagree. I think that BP ought to be seized by the U.S. government at this point. All of its assets, all of its operations, it should be totally taken over by the United States. It should be the first oil company nationalized by the United States. We should reverse the process that Mohammad Mossadegh tried to do in 1953 until he was overthrown by the CIA. Just nationalize. And after BP is nationalized, then go ahead and nationalize every single oil company that operates anywhere in, around, or near the United States. And then blow them all up. It's blow them up. Because once we seize them, once we nationalize them, then we could have this national dialogue where wise people would point out to us that continuing to burn fossil fuel like oil is continuing to guarantee that we are all going to choke to death and die. And since very few of us, except maybe the pig man, Rush Limbaugh, or Glenn Beck, wants to choke to death and die, we might do the smart thing then and destroy these companies. Literally destroy them. Nationalize them, and then take a team of demolition experts around every single oil refinery, every single drilling, make sure everything is sealed off, and then blow the sons of bitches up and just bring all this to a stop. You like that idea? I love it. We'll be right back. It is 7 past the hour. What does this say? Tom writes, Mike, this is in response to what I said about nationalizing BP, nationalizing all the oil industries, all the carbon industries, and then destroying them, blow them all up. Mike, nationalizing energy and oil is a great idea, but costly to oil and its corrupt agents, but it may be too late. I think they've already thought of that, and this disaster could easily be seen as a well-placed Halliburton bullet to the belly of America. After all, in the mind of BP, the oil cartel, and every other self-interested corporation, they understand that it's them or us. Now they can just wait it out, bleed us to death from below while they take out our economy, our livelihoods, poison our food chain, shut down port trade, and in 3 months they have done more damage than $1 trillion in missiles and bombs from a hostile nation could only dream of doing. If there is no USA, then there's no courts, no liability, and nothing but a broken up piece of polluted trash to be sold for scrap and the population that comes with it. Well, they don't care about themselves. Why should they, Tom? What is interesting to me is I think that the real piece of failed equipment that brought this disaster, you know, other than the whole idea of punching holes in the floor of the ocean being just insanity, just total insanity. But once you get past that and get to the actual mechanics of what happened, this was Dick Cheney's kick in the scrotum to the United States, assuming the United States has a male persona, maybe female, who knows. But this was Dick Cheney's kick into the privates. Let's put it that way. Kellogg, Brown & Root, Halliburton, they have been poisoning our soldiers. They have been electrocuting our service personnel. They've been feeding our people with their military contracts, poison food, poison water. Halliburton, KBR, all of them. All this patriotic horse crap that they spout out, it means nothing, absolutely nothing. The people who run Halliburton and anyone who owns stock in Halliburton is a traitor to what's left of the United States. In a different time, a different place, these people would have been taken out and executed months ago, years ago. But that's not where we live. Just like the people in the United States, the good conservatives back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, or 20s and 30s, who wanted to build up Hitler, who wanted to build the Wehrmacht to make sure that the Germans could get rid of some of the, not just the Jews, but some of the lesser people in Europe. And, you know, it's the Bush family, the Ford family, the family that ran DuPont, the Lindbergh family, industrialists up and down the entire ladder of American corporatism wanted to form an alliance with Hitler. And first of all, get rid of the Jews. I don't think there was any more of an anti-Semite in American industry than Henry Ford. He would froth at the mouth about Jewish people. But I don't know. When I think about what BP has done, what they continue to do, what are we in the fourth week now? Third week, fourth week of a spill that we were told, oh, well, it's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. It's okay. We got it under control. It'll never happen anyway. And now that it has happened, don't worry about it. Very small, a little event. Don't think about it. Look over here. And to think that there are Republicans, and by that I mean most of these right-wing psychopaths, who see nothing wrong with this. You know, they see it as I don't know. It's stunning. I know y'all get tired of this every night. I understand. What is this? This is from Brad. Dear Mike, sweet release. What sweet surrender it was to let go of all faith and hope for anything like a future for the United States. The continent has been raped of all its beauty, resources, wildlife, and heritage. The waters have been poisoned and rendered useless. The mountains have been blown to bits. And there will come an end to all this satanic waste, and that time will be after every square centimeter has been turned into a lifeless dead zone. Among the seemingly endless list of logical fallacies can be found one particular fallacy given a name so unfortunate as to make it hard to believe. It's real, though, and you can look it up, although I'm sure you know of it. Hitlerum ad absurdum. This is a fallacy of using Adolf Hitler as a target for comparison when building a case against an opponent. When I look around, however, the comparisons to pre-Nazi Germany are right in my face. In the late 20s and early 30s, I have to believe that the Austrians, Poles, and Germans looked around and saw it coming. After all, those with the means to do so fled. Well, the getting was good. Those who could not flee, well, you know. This time, the fascism is orders of magnitude more sophisticated and insidious. It's all weaved throughout the fabric of our entire computer networking and media. It has no single dictator, just a bunch of corporate pukes in suits who will never see the inside of a prison cell, in part because their corporations built the damn prison cells to begin with. You can't include the government in this list, however, because there is no such thing. This thing we call our government is merely the second law of magic, namely misdirection. The first law is to never reveal the secret of the trick. Am I proud to be an American? Blank no. For one thing, I have no right to say that I'm proud of something I had no part in creating in the first place. I am here only by sheer accident of birth. I'm proud of my musical accomplishments. I'm proud I don't smoke tobacco anymore. For that matter, if there is anything I think we could use a lot less of in this country, it's blind, meaningless nationalism. about the days when all who could escape the horror they saw coming round the Teutonic Mountain. Think on this. They had some place to go. Many took to steerage to get to this country. This time around, there would be no place to go. Carry on, Brad. I think Brad was a little down in the mouth there when he wrote that. Bye-bye. Oh, by the way, there's nothing to fear if you live in the Keys or you have visited Key West or the Florida Keys. If you acknowledge that the Keys contain, what is it, 60, 70, 80% of all the coral reefs in the continental or within the reach of the continental United States, there's nothing to worry about. BP sent one of their people down there to assure everything would be fine. To gather all the people. You know, I've spent enough time in Key West at Mallory Square and down on Duval Street and just hanging out, going to Hemingway's and getting drunk. What's that other place I used to go to? Captain Tony's. Go down to Captain Tony's and just, drink exotic drinks until I threw up my eyes. That was a long time ago. Just hanging out. And of course, Key West has changed since those days. I mean, it's become all gentrified, and I guess I have friends who go down there. My son Chris was down there about a year ago and said, it's really changed, Dad. But the people of Key West, there's still a heavy-duty contingent of people in Key West. You know, there used to be a sign down there that says, Key West, where you wind up when there's no place left to go. And I just wonder how those people are feeling now that their way of living has just about been blown to pieces. And in order to assuage all those fears, BP sent a spokesperson down there. And when we come back from this break that we're almost in, I will tell you what the spokesperson said. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Before they can get us back, I'm not even gonna bother to argue over that, 'cause it's clear.
From the moment you wake and leave the house in the morning, the terrorists or Democrats strike without warning. So till you're back safe in bed, wear a bucket on your head. That's what I said. And to show your support for right-wing ideology, the raids on Iraq and the rape of the ecology, while the treasury's being bled, keep a bucket on your head.
21 past the hour. All right, so here's the deal. Is this from the LA Times? Where's this from? I gotta know where it's from. Hank, it's from Hank Tester, who's a writer. He's been covering, NBC in Miami. He's been covering news and politics in South Florida for 20 years. And he says a BP executive went to Key West to reassure the people down there that the oil spill's not coming. He says the sense of panic that swept through the Florida Keys following last week's rumors of the Gulf oil spill's imminent arrival was nearly gone Tuesday as BP yesterday sent its white knight to assure folks that everything would be fine. The BP guy, Keith Silhan showed up wearing a T-shirt and carrying a backpack. BP exec. He comes with a T-shirt and a backpack. It was perfect. Most of the folks in the crowd had on T-shirts, shorts, baseball caps. Silhan fit right in and said all the right things. He smiled when a few barbs were thrown his way. He played the role of the concerned junior exec who was not responsible for what some are calling the nation's biggest oil spill disaster, but could sure carry a message back to the boss. Silhan was sitting with almost every local public official you can name in the Florida Keys. It was surprisingly civil. He was treated gently. The Keys have been under threat for several weeks. The culprit was the blown wellhead, the Deepwater Horizon explosion, yada, 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 yada. The result of the oil flow, environmentalists believe, could be an oil slick invading the Keys, mangroves, marinas, and beaches. Seelhan was one of the scheduled speakers at the county commission workshops. Nothing formal, just remarks, but what he said was soaked in by the attentive crowd of charter captains, fishing guides, motel operators, restaurateurs, and just plain folks from up and down the island chain. BP's man said, "We are not in immediate danger. What is not going to hit the Keys is a large black pool of oil. It is not likely to happen at all." Likely. "I do not think it is possible, to be honest with you." I do think it's possible. If oil does get into the loop current, according to this BP freak, by the time it gets to the Keys, it would be weathered oil. Weathered oil. What the BP exec was saying is exactly what Tom Hill from Key Largo Fisheries had been saying for the last couple of days. He admits that he had been real concerned about the oil. Now, Mr. Hill has concluded that if the oil ever got the Keys, it would be not much more than some tar balls. Oh. Seelhan told the group that BP will resolve the impact on commerce and would be on scene for a full-scale cleanup. If oil did impact the coral rock and mangroves that ring the Keys. When the meeting was over, the BP man was chatted up by members of the crowd and the meeting participants. Was there a sigh of relief? Kind of, for now. BP's man had done his job. "We'll help you clean up the mangroves." Now, see, that's what is infuriating. I would think at that point, the people listening, the people who live in the Keys, as soon as the guy said that, why didn't they string him up? Why didn't they all stand up and say, "You're lying, you're a corporate murderer, you're going to kill all of us with your plundering," and then just bring out a real thick rope and just string him up from one of the nearby palm trees? Because the guy was sitting there with his shorts and his backpack lying through his teeth, especially the part about if it comes into your mangroves and your precious coral, we'll clean it up. You can't clean it up. You can't. Once oil, we were talking about this the other night. Once oil gets into a mangrove estuary or swamp, it will never come out. For all eternity, it's there. I can't believe that. That's not the way I remember the Conks, people who live in the Keys. That's what they were called, Conks. There probably aren't any Conks left. It's probably all developers and tourists. And of course, when I went there, I was a tourist. Used to be able to stay in Key West. There's a place down Duval Street called the Southern Cross Hotel. $18 a night. Right on Duval Street, $18 a night. And the room was real thin, no toilet. You had to go down the hall to take a leak. But the room was real thin and real narrow is what I'm trying to say. Real high ceiling to try to ease some of the heat. And one of those fans in the ceiling. Palmetto bugs all over the place. People up north don't know what a palmetto bug is. Let me tell you, it's your worst nightmare. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy.
right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. I think it's time for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Gather around, kiddies. It's time once again for Uncle Mike's Story Corner, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling, where we all gather together and get all comfortable right before we go CP time and have a story. Tonight's story is entitled Rust Belt Rage, and it's written by Noam Chomsky. On February 18th, Joe Stack, a 53-year-old computer engineer, crashed his small plane into a building in Austin, Texas, hitting an IRS office, committing suicide, killing one other person, and injuring others. Stack left an anti-government manifesto explaining his actions. The story begins when he was a teenager living on a pittance in Harrisburg, PA, near the heart of what was once a great industrial center. His neighbor, in her 80s and surviving on cat food, was, according to Stack, the widowed wife of a retired steelworker. Her husband had served all his life in the steel mills of central Pennsylvania with promises from big business and the union that for his 30 years of service, he would have a pension and medical care to look forward to in his retirement. Instead, he was one of the thousands who got nothing because the incompetent mill management and corrupt union, not to mention the government, raided their pension funds and stole their retirement. All she had was Social Security to live on. He could have added that the super rich and their political allies continued to try to take away Social Security, too. Stack decided that he couldn't trust big business and would strike out on his own, only to discover that he also couldn't trust a government that cared nothing about people like him, but only about the rich and privileged, or a legal system in which, quote, there are two interpretations for every law, one for the very rich and one for the rest of us, end quote. Joe Stack. The government leaves us with, Stack wrote, the joke we call the American medical system, including the drug and insurance companies that are murdering tens of thousands of people a year with care rationed largely by wealth, not need. Joe Stack. Stack traces these ills to a social order in which, quote, a handful of thugs and plunderers can commit unthinkable atrocities, and when it's time for their gravy train to crash under the weight of their gluttony and overwhelming stupidity, the force of the full federal government has no difficulty coming to their aid within days, if not hours. Joe Stack. Stack's manifesto ends with two evocative sentences, quote, the communist creed, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. The capitalist creed, from each according to his gullibility, to each according to his greed. Joe Stack. Poignant studies of the U.S. Rust Belt reveal comparable outrage among individuals who have been cast aside as state corporate programs close plants and destroy families and communities. An acute sense of betrayal comes readily to people who believed they had fulfilled their duty to society in a moral compact with business and government, only to discover they had been only instruments of profit and power. Striking similarities exist in China, the world's second largest economy. Investigated by UCLA scholar Ching Quan Lee, Lee has compared working class outrage and desperation in the discarded industrial sectors of the U.S. and in what she calls China's Rust Belt, the state socialist industrial center in the Northeast, now abandoned for state capitalist development of the Southeast Sun Belt. In both regions, Lee found massive labor protests, but different in character. In the Rust Belt, workers expressed the same sense of betrayal as their U.S. counterparts. In their case, the betrayal of the Maoist principles of solidarity and dedication to development of the society that they thought had been a moral compact, only to discover that whatever it was, it is now bitter fraud. Around the country, scores of millions of workers dropped from work units, Lee writes, quote, are plagued by a profound sense of insecurity, arousing rage and desperation. Lee's work and studies of the U.S. Rust Belt make clear that we should not underestimate the depth of moral indignation that lies behind the furious, often self-destructive bitterness about government and business power. In the U.S., the Tea Party movement, and even more so the broader circles it reaches, reflect the spirit of disenchantment. The Tea Party's anti-tax extremism is not as immediately suicidal as Joe Stack's protest, but it is a suicidal movement nonetheless. California today is a dramatic illustration. The world's greatest public system of higher education is being dismantled. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says he'll have to eliminate state health and welfare programs unless the federal government forks over some $7 billion. Other governors are joining in. Meanwhile, a newly powerful states' rights movement is demanding that the federal government not intrude into our affairs. A nice illustration of what George Orwell called doublethink, the ability to hold two contradictory ideas in mind while believing both of them. Practically a motto for our times. California's plight results in large part from anti-tax fanaticism. It's much the same elsewhere, even in affluent suburbs. Encouraging anti-tax sentiment has long been a staple of business propaganda. People must be indoctrinated to hate and fear the government for good reasons. Of the existing power systems, the government is the one that in principle, and sometimes in fact, answers to the public and can constrain the depredations of private power. However, anti-government propaganda must be nuanced. Business, of course, favors a powerful state that works for multinationals and financial institutions and even bails them out when they destroy the economy. But in a brilliant exercise in doublethink, people are led to hate and fear the deficit. That way, businesses' cohorts in Washington may agree to cut benefits and entitlements like Social Security, but never cut the bailouts. At the same time, people should not oppose what is largely creating the deficit, the growing military budget and the hopelessly inefficient privatized healthcare system. It is easy to ridicule how Joe Stack and others like him articulate their concerns, but it's far more appropriate to understand what lies behind their perceptions and actions at a time when people with real grievances are being mobilized in ways that pose no slight danger to themselves and to others. Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Tonight, Rust Belt Rage by Noam Chomsky. This first appeared on the web only, at In These Times. All brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. It is a few minutes before the next break here, and when we come back after this break that's coming up, we're going to take your phone calls. If you'd like to join in, the number is 877-996-2556. JL writes, Mike, a great article called Welcome to Pipelinistan. I forgot the journalist's name, but Google it. He's well-versed in the importance of the Caspian Sea area and the oil and gas producers north of Afghanistan. Also, Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, lays out the idea that to steal the resources of Eurasia, where there's more oil and mineral wealth than anywhere in the world, we need to lay down a military footprint in Iraq. And last but not least, Webster Tarpley's book, Synthetic Terror 911. The first chapter will surprise you on how important heroin is to the CIA. The CIA has their own bank on Wall Street, and $500 to $800 billion a year comes out of the heroin trade in Afghanistan. You'll be surprised how that money is used. J.L. Yeah, I've heard that for years, especially during the 80s when people like Robert Perry ripped open the lies of the CIA where it concerned the drug trade. and how it was used to fund our terror wars, the CIA's terrorism against the people of Central America. 500 to 800 billion, I'm surprised it's not more than that. That was in response to the question that I tossed out there, purely rhetorical, because, you know, I understand, and so does everybody who has written in tonight with the answer, why are we in Afghanistan? We understand why we're in Afghanistan. What I was looking for, though, is some right-winger to tell me that we're in Afghanistan for freedom and justice and so that all the little girls in Afghanistan can go to school. That's what I was hoping to hear. We'll be right back. For the hour, phone number here is 877-996-2556 if you want to chat. Robert is in Illinois listening on XM. Hey, Robert.
Hi, how you doing tonight, sir?
All right.
You know, I got to be honest with you. You know, for me, being interested in what our government does and what it doesn't do all goes back to September 11th for me.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it wasn't so much what was told to me on that day, but the things that weren't told to me afterwards and the things that, preceded that very quickly after that, the signing of the Patriot Act, us going to war with Iraq,
mm-hmm.
the fact that Iraq, I think it was, what, 6 or 9 months, Saddam Hussein said he was going to increase oil production,
mm-hmm.
and you hear about the energy meetings, which I think were a year and a half before that, where they were already slicing Iraq up.
Right.
I mean, and then for me, the reason I care is because my friend that I grew up with, he's gone over there 5 times. This is his 5th tour.
Mm.
And, he's a different person.
Sure.
I still love him. He's still my friend. He's a great father, a great husband, but he's different because of it. And I just think it's extremely selfish. And this is why I think it was either on your program or another program, I don't know who it was, but they were saying, you know, let these older people in our government die off. Let them go away, because they are not the future of our country.
Mm-hmm.
They are not the people that have a vested interest in what happened. They're not going to see, the fruits of their decisions and their labor.
Right.
You know, I mean, I grew up working class my whole life. My dad's a truck driver. My mother worked at Jewel, had a small business. You know, I always taught the importance of hard work and dedication,
mm-hmm.
honesty. You know, my grandma used to say to me, you respect everyone. Even people that hurt you, even people that do mean things to you, you respect them. My grandma was Sicilian. She grew up in Sicily. She said, but trust, people have to earn trust. And what I don't like is how politicians get upset, how all these people across the country are expressing not only anger, but disbelief when they say one thing and do another. People are getting upset because people are going back to those values, and I think September 11th had a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea that at a moment, people can be gone. And if we don't start appreciating each other and actually loving each other, even the people that disgust us, even the people that we disagree with, even people that make their women wear veils over their heads or that, cut people's hands off for stealing, that is their way of life. We can't put a McDonald's on every corner and a Starbucks across the street. We can't do that. we have to appreciate, you know, the process of what these cultures went through, and we have to appreciate those and respect those. And I don't think people do that enough. And I think if we did that more, you know, war would be not be an option, because war is a result of failed policy. For me, war, you know, I grew up getting my butt kicked my whole life. Then finally, I saw my brother beat up two guys that were going to beat me up. And my brother was in Taekwondo and Aikido and kickboxing and karate, which made me want to do that. And you want to know what it is if you can't talk to somebody, you have to fight them. And no longer does America do that. We immediately go, oh, you don't agree with us? Pow.
Mm-hmm.
Now do what we want. And you want to know what's happening? All those people that we beat up, they took Taekwondo and Aikido, and they've come back and said, you want to know what? You beat all of us up for no reason.
Yeah.
And people are tired of us, and you want to know what it is? They're pissed off at our government. Not me, not my parents, not you. And it's time for the people that are this country to stand up and let the people that run this country that were, can I swear on your program? Probably not, right?
Not right.
Okay, that we're effing tired of it.
Yeah.
We are tired of it. My blood, my sweat, and my tears, watching my parents work themselves into an early grave to give me an opportunity, and then have it taken away from them because somebody wanted to gamble on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Where I grew up in Melrose Park, that didn't happen. Somebody wronged you like that, someone hit your girlfriend, someone did something wrong like that, someone blatantly disrespected you. You took care of it like a man.
Right. Well, the rest of the world has never had a chance to take care of the disrespect that we've shown them, as you would say, take care of it like a man, because we have been, you know, after World War II, we ran everything, and the parts that we didn't run, we were willing to send people to their deaths in our competition with the Soviet Union. But going back to what you said about, you know, people have got to work together. They've got to start thinking in more of a we're in this together kind of. That's not what you said, but I understand what you meant. But you know, my question would be, how do you do that in a system like ours? As Chomsky has pointed out, as a lot of people have pointed out, corporate/political America. They're not interested in people and their networks. As a matter of fact, they're doing everything they can to destroy those networks, and to make them impossible to form. When you have people who are competing for a limited amount of resources, if the resources happen to be a job or health care or food, when you have people competing like that, it's very difficult, especially if they're desperate, it's very difficult to get people to think in terms of networking and working together, to reestablish their own sanctity, the sanctity of life. If you're watching your child dying of childhood leukemia because you don't have a health insurance, or your husband is going slowly insane because he can't find work, or you, are desperate for anything that would keep your family together, and you understand that all that is happening because of the system in which you're trying to function, it's very difficult to transcend that. Thanks for checking in, Robert. We have to break here. We'll be right back. We have two open lines. Jump in here and join us. Welcome back. Oh my God, I sound like I'm screaming. It is 7 past the hour. All right, we do I have anything else before we go to go to your phone calls? Anything else I want to? JD wrote this. I've written to you before. I'm pleased with the coverage you've been giving to the Gulf catastrophe and the contemptible and sloppy coverage it has received. Kudos to Bobby Kennedy and Mike Papantonio as well for getting at the root causes, which is the fact that the government agency MMS is corrupt, the media is inept, and the government bureaucrats didn't do their job in protecting us from the venal exploiters. I have been a professional ecologist for 35 years. No group of people deserves a hotter place in hell than eco whores, which include these people of this phony environmental group. The New York Times should issue a public apology for this article and lack of disclosure. I don't have that article in front of me, my friend, so I'm not exactly... Oh, here it is. The Gulf of Mexico Foundation. Yeah, right. That was the organization that said, and we talked about this a couple of nights ago, or maybe it was last week. I think it was this week. The so-called Gulf of Mexico Corporation that is, what is it? The Gulf of Mexico Foundation. At least half of the 19 members on the group's board of directors have direct ties to the offshore drilling industry. One of them is currently an executive at Transocean, the company that owns the rig that exploded. 7 other board members are currently employed as oil companies or at companies that provide products and services, primarily to the offshore and gas industry. But JD is referring to this Dr. Quentin Dokken, the executive director of the Gulf of Mexico Foundation. It was in the New York Times, May 4th, in a story headlined, Gulf Oil Spill is Bad, But How Bad? And this guy, Quentin Dokken, said, the sky is not falling. We've certainly stepped in a hole, and we're going to have to work ourselves out of it, but it isn't the end of the Gulf of Mexico. And the New York Times describes this group as a conservation group. But ProPublica reports about all the members of the board who are involved with Shell Oil, Shell ConocoPhillips, LLOG Exploration Company, Devon Energy, Anadarko Petroleum Company, and Oceaneering International. This is one of those AstroTurf organizations that, you know, you see something called the Gulf of Mexico Foundation, you think, oh yeah, they want to save the plankton and the baby turtles and the sea life. And they don't give a damn about that. This is the way capitalism works. This is the way corporatism works. It lies, it cheats, it steals. It is immoral. It is illogical. It is anti-life, anti-family. And to all the teabagger Republicans who think corporate America is wonderful, you people are going to get exactly what you deserve for your ignorance. You really are. Anyway, JD says, regarding the spill, the field size of 50 to 100 million barrels, and with the estimated 75 days, nearly 11 weeks, to create the relief well, implies the worst case of 12 million barrels escaping into the Gulf. And please refer to the dome as a steel condom, which is exactly what it is. I suppose it's possible that the discharge will stop short of 100 million gallons just because the field pressure may be seriously depleted in future weeks. I think, though, that this is an unknown. Keep in mind that we're 4 days away from the onset of the hurricane season in the Gulf. This promises increasingly adverse sea conditions and difficulties in keeping the oil out of the precious mangrove and salt marshes so critical to all marine life in the Gulf. What's happened here is a crime against humanity and the biosphere. It's from JD. Yeah, sure. I understand. Keeping the oil out of the mangrove and salt marshes is just a matter literally of life and death. And you heard the guy, I quoted the guy who from NBC Miami who sat in on this meeting with the BP exec who told the Key West and the Key, up and down the Keys, the residents, well, if the oil gets into your mangrove marshes, don't worry, we'll clean it up. And such a cleanup is physically impossible. I mean, it can't be done. It just cannot be done. But this is what capitalism does. And every once in a while, I still get phone calls from geeks who, well, I just found your program on XM, and you really are a commie. Why don't you go to Cuba? You know, I get those kind. They send me emails, and I usually ignore them. But they don't understand or refuse to understand, because if I understand it, they can understand it. This is not brain surgery. You know, this is very easy to understand. Corporate America, capitalism as a system and corporate America as a function of that system, is anti-life, anti-family, pro-death, pro-war, pro-destruction. It destroys jobs, hopes, dreams, savings that people put together. Attempts to work cooperatively. Capitalism doesn't want cooperation. Jesus Christ, that's why they're so anti-union. You know, the national, Chamber of Commerce. The last thing they want to see and what they work desperately to sabotage is the unionization of the workforce in this country or any country. Cooperation implies power. Power implies counterforce to capitalism. I mean, capitalism, why is it that people don't get this? I mean, if you want to operate within a corrupt system, which we all do, and now we're feeling the bite from that, okay, at least acknowledge that it is a murderous, corrupt system. If you think you can keep your head and your the head of your children and your spouse up above the suck of this as it pulls you down to your death, okay, have at it. But at least stop with the denial. Stop with the illusion that capitalism has anything good to offer anybody, anywhere, at any time. Period. It doesn't. If you happen to operate within a capitalist system and you're not dead, you are not dead in spite of capitalism, not because of it. In spite of it. You think capitalism gives you a job? Is that what you think? How's that working out for you? I'm not anti-business. I'm not anti-small business. I'm not anti the idea of trade people, you know, people who work in people that have farms, people that produce furniture, people that do art, people that do commerce. I'm not against that. I mean, come on, I'm not a fool. You may hate me for my politics, but don't ever consider I'm a fool, because I'm not. I'm not. Capitalism, though, is none of that. Capitalism sinks its fangs into your throat and the throat of your children and your grandchildren and sucks until there's nothing left. You teabaggers don't get that, do you?
You measure your peace with guns. Your progress is in megatons. Well, who's left when the war is won? A soldier of a misfortune. A soldier of an angry call. Soldiers on foreign soil. Well, we're not here to fight your war, 'cause we know what you're fighting for. Oh, oh.
with the truth. It's More Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. A quick email here. This is from Andre. It's from the AP, I guess. Procter & Gamble company says it has rushed 1,000 bottles of Dawn dishwashing liquid to the Gulf of Mexico region to help clean wildlife soiled by the massive oil spill. A P&G spokeswoman says the shipment from a Kansas City plant was delivered by truck Saturday, and another 1,000 bottles are being readied. Wildlife rescue workers have used Dawn dishwashing detergent for more than 3 decades. Cincinnati-based Procter & Gamble has ongoing partnerships with the International Bird Rescue Research Center and the Marine Mammal Center to provide Dawn and to raise funds. In honor of Earth Day in April, before the severity of the Gulf spill was recognized, P&G stepped up airing a television commercial tied to fundraising for bird rescue efforts. Now, I guess we should be grateful for that, right? I mean, Procter & Gamble, this corporation that provides just tons of pollution into the nation's waterways and drinking water and into the production of food. But I guess we should be grateful that this corporation is showing responsibility, right? They're sending thousands of bottles of Dawn dishwashing detergent. Isn't detergent one of those, or the chemicals that make up detergent, one of those collections of environment befouling crap that environmentalists have been warning against for 5 decades now? But Procter & Gamble, you see, is a socially responsible capitalist corporation, right? Which puts the lie to everything I have been saying about how capitalism doesn't care. Well, here's Procter & Gamble. By God, they care, Mike. God damn. Yeah, okay. That's really good. P&G, thanks for sending the dishwashing detergent. I think it's wonderful. Mike's in Chicago. So what do you think, Mike? Is it good to send Dawn dishwashing detergent or not?
Hey, Mike. Well, first of all, me and you both grew up, especially in me in Chicago, with phosphorus-based detergents.
That's true.
Which, yeah, I mean, it's like, oh, yeah, it cleans your dishes really well. Just don't put it down the sink. That's
right.
Right. But you know what? Going off-roading for a sec, here's what the Senate needs to ask Kagan, which I don't foresee it happening, but I understand as far as the abortion, don't ask, don't tell, same-sex marriage, she can claim conflict of interest because it may be a deciding factor in one of her upcoming cases.
Mm-hmm.
But she can clearly say, okay, Eric Holder has clearly stated that he wouldn't be pursuing charges against the Bush administration, so do you think he should, if not, pursue charges against Rumsfeld, Bush, and Cheney, and if not, why? What is the Geneva Convention for? And why do you think that there is, if there should be, a faith-based initiative office in the White House? Do you believe that there should be? And see what she says about that.
Well,
Karen Santorum in 2006 was on James Dobson's radio show for Focus on the Family,
mm-hmm.
and said the following. She said, housewives who work outside the house is the work of the devil,
right.
And she wouldn't be tempted. What do you think about, you know, people who are so far right, who are so religious right, and they've got so much influence in the government? What do you think about this? And just see what she says, because it's not anything she's going to be obviously seeing in the future, and see her opinion. Because what scares me the most is the right is not mad enough. They're so crazed as it is about everything that they're not mad enough about this issue. And that's the thing that's got me scared about Elena Kagan. And I just wanted to bounce that off you.
Well, Elena Kagan is not going to say poop with a mouth full of it. The people questioning her will not ask her these questions. It's common knowledge now, thanks to Dan Frumkin. who used to write for the Washington Post, but he provided too much truth for him. They couldn't take it. So they let him go. But Frumkin now writes for a lot of places, including Huffington Post. And he just wrote 15 years ago, listen to this, 15 years ago, Elena Kagan penned a passionate and eloquent critique of the modern Supreme Court confirmation process, calling it a, quote, vapid and hollow charade in which repetition of platitudes has replaced discussion of viewpoints and personal anecdotes have supplanted legal analysis, end quote. In other words, Elena Kagan 15 years ago really raised hell about how these Supreme Court nominees are just, I mean, it's a joke and it's a scam. But according to Dan Frumkin, the White House is indicating that now that she's a Supreme Court nominee, Kagan doesn't want to live up to her own standards.
And that's what, you know, Mike, that's a really good point you just brought up, because of the fact that if someone's desire to be in the Supreme Court overrides their moralistic values,
mm-hmm.
they will say whatever it takes to get to be the shoe-in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the way the game is played now. Mike, thanks. Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
Stay ignorant, be remedial, wear the best caps, slouch over and cool like a hunchback. Don't discuss things, shout the last word. Put your good sense out the pasture. Drop your IQ, that's what I do. My advice to girls and guys who want to be a Nobel Prize finalist. Rocket scientists, try applying this. Keep the customers coming around.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. From Bill in Allentown, PA. Mike, thanks for that Uncle Mike story corner. Here in Allentown, over the past 20 years, the economy has been sliced to pieces. First Mack Trucks moved its big plant to South Carolina, and thousands of jobs were lost. In the 90s, Bethlehem Steel just shut its doors and thousands more jobs were lost. I personally know 10 to 15 people lost their job to either one of those monsters. When Mack Trucks shut its doors, I started to wonder if that Billy Joel song was a predictor or prediction. Unfortunately, he turned out to be a prophet about what happened here. As I look back, though, he was doing then what you and all the other truth seekers do. We analyze the situation in front of us. One more thing, those of you who do not yet have a podcast subscription, get one. Which leads me, thanks, Bill, which leads me to, this program will disappear forever if we do not really increase the number of podcast subscribers very soon. I hate to put it that way, but it is the absolute truth. And podcast subscription will cost you about $59 a year or $7.95 a month. And I don't think we even got all of the people who originally subscribed a little over a year ago when we first went on the air this way to resubscribe. If that's because you are destitute and broke, okay, I certainly understand that. I've been in that situation myself. But if you're listening to this program and you can afford $7.95 a month or $60 a year, which works out to 25 cents a program, you've got to get in touch with us. Go to MikeMalloy.com and you'll see how to subscribe. Because we I don't talk about it because I don't want to freak anybody out, but we are rapidly approaching, with little Malloy Broadcasting here, a tipping point. And, excuse me, once this tips, there's no coming back. There just isn't. We don't work for anybody. We don't work for a network. We're not funded by right-wing crazy people. We're not funded by left-wing crazy people. We're not funded by anybody. Liberals don't give a tinker's damn whether programs like mine live or die. I mean, rich liberals. They couldn't care less. Nobody in all the years that I've been doing broadcasting has ever stepped forward and said, look, we'll fund what you're doing. Right wingers have more money, you know, people like Beck, and it's not because they have big audiences. It's because they get big coverage. The audience is there. The audience is sitting around playing with itself, and all of a sudden out of the shadows steps Glenn Beck. Hello! You know, or Rush Limbaugh. I'm not even going to go into that. I don't care how they do it, what they do. It doesn't matter to me. But if you want to see this program continue, and a lot of people don't, and that's okay too. But if you do want to see it continue, you've got to seriously consider subscribing to the podcast, the commercial free podcast downloads. We need probably 1,000 subscribers. Now, I know from looking at how many people log on, excuse me, how many people log on to the website. We have Arbitrons from the stations that carry us that do subscribe to Arbitron. We literally have several million listeners, and in any given week. And you little creepy trolls, you don't have to write me and tell me, oh, you do not, you know, eat, poop, and die. Anyway, with that number of listeners, it would seem to me that getting 4,000 or 5,000, subscribers would not be that difficult. So that's my little pitch. If you want this program to continue, you will subscribe. It's that simple. And, you know, we don't get into these big tirades about subscribe, subscribe. But if this program disappears, you'll know what happened, that not enough people subscribe. Not because anyone fired us. We cannot be fired. We cannot be. The only thing that will take us off the air is if we simply run out of money and to stay on the air. And we're approaching that point. That will make a lot of baggers and right-wingers and trolls and lumps and crazy people and monkeys very happy, because it'll mean one more liberal voice gone. And then they can sit back in their excrement and say, see, the marketplace won't support it, see? Which is not the case. The case is radio stations, very few radio stations, relatively speaking, will carry liberal talk, because I scare the Christ out of them. I scare them to death because of the things I talk about. Isn't that amazing? You can have some subhuman like Glenn Beck, or some piece of human waste like Limbaugh, a drug-addicted child molester, doing a program on 600 or 700 stations. Nobody ever says a word. Nobody says a word. But get somebody like me out there talking about U.S. foreign policy as terrorism. Whoa, we can't put him on the air. Son of a bitch. We'll, I don't know. We'll have complaints. So the advertisers will flee. Well, they won't, but... So what we rely on, you know, I had somebody send me an email the other night and said, well, isn't your program capitalism? No, it is not. You dumbass. It's pure socialism. Purely. People who want to hear the program, throw some money in the hat. Very simple. There's not an advertiser on this program that we couldn't tell to go away. I can't tell you how many ads have been offered to us from companies that I will not do business with. You will hear some ads on here that you may think, well, why is Malloy? Those are not ours. They come from our affiliates or wherever. So it's very simple. This program, the lifeblood of this program is, it's not contributions. I'm not talking about, I'm not asking you to make a contribution. The lifeblood of this program is people who subscribe to the commercial free podcast downloads. Okay? So we're at your mercy. We really are. About Elena Kagan, yeah, Dan Frumkin points out that back in 1995, right after she was a Senate Judiciary Committee staffer during the confirmation hearings of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And if you remember, and I don't, but Frumkin here fills us in, Ginsburg avoided just about every single question. But Kagan wrote that nominees should be prepared to openly discuss their, quote, understanding of the role of the courts in our society, of the nature of and values embodied in our Constitution, and the proper tools and techniques of interpretation, both constitutional and statutory, end quote. That's what Elena Kagan wrote 15 years ago. She also said that because, quote, those statements of judicial philosophy may be so abstract as to leave uncertain, especially to the public, much about the real-world consequences, she wrote that senators should insist on seeing how theory works in practice by evoking a nominee's comments on particular issues involving privacy rights, free speech, race, gender discrimination, so forth. The type of stuff the court regularly faces. End quote. Now, I will guarantee you that, first of all, when Elena Kagan is questioned by the Senate Judiciary Committee, she will bend over backwards to not answer specifically. Who was it that called from Chicago? Mike. As Mike pointed out, if one senator would say to her, do you think that George Bush and Dick Cheney should be tried for war crimes because of their absolute violation of Geneva Conventions to which the United States is bound legally? That would not involve anything that would a case that would come before her. You can make the argument that if they were tried, they wouldn't be tried in an American court. They would be tried for crimes against humanity at The Hague. So on review, it would never go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But you can bet your ass that Elena Kagan would never answer a question. Elena Kagan, you might as well understand this, truth seeker, is a conservative. She is a corporatist. She is a very sympathetic, although I don't think she's ever been a member of, the Federalist Society. So, you know, once again, here we go. Because the president happens to be African-American, oh, he must be a liberal. Because Elena Kagan happens to be Jewish, oh, well, she must be liberal. Because she's female, oh, she must be liberal. Because she's gay, oh, she must be liberal. None of that stuff is true. People are not liberal because of their skin color or their sexual orientation or their gender. They are liberal if they develop a judicial or political philosophy that is pro-people. They become conservative if they develop a philosophy that is pro-corporation. We'll be right back. Ten before the hour, Charlie is calling from Atlanta.
Hi, Mike. Good evening.
Oh, hey. How are you?
I'm great. So glad to hear you're on the air.
Yeah.
Been following you since the days of Air America. So
those were the good old days, Charlie.
Indeed, they were.
Yeah.
Can't imagine you going off the airways. So I do hope that we can muster up some support.
Yeah, it just, like I said, we're not looking for charity or donations. We're just looking for people to subscribe to the downloads. And it's very simple to do, and hopefully enough people will do that.
Well, you've convinced me.
Oh, good.
Well, tonight I just wanted to call and mention a trend or two that I've been noticing that really alarms me. Essentially, it's been the erosion of individual civil liberties,
mm-hmm,
concurrent with the rise of like this corporate shadow government.
Right. Only it's not so shadow anymore, is it, Charlie?
Yeah, it's really really well out in the open now. We actually have even people in the media calling those they disagree with terrorists. U.S. citizens are called terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Laws are being enacted that strip away what are supposed to be constitutionally protected rights for U.S. citizens, like the right to free speech or the right to congregate or the right to protest, if, in fact, those actions impact the profits of whatever corporations probably sponsored the law. The one I'm referencing right now is the AETA, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, where...
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you say something that impacts the profits of the cattlemen's association or whatever, they won't just sue you for libel. They'll lock you in jail and call you a terrorist and potentially sentence you much harder than they would a murderer or a rapist or, you know, a more violent criminal.
Imagine what's going to happen with what remains of the union movement in this country when... a union decides to go out on strike and is ordered by the corporation to come back to work, and and the union refuses, and then certain aspects of the USA Patriot Act, the renewal of that Patriot Act, which lists as a form of terrorism any kind of civil disobedience or civil disturbance. Wait until they try to lock up union workers. Of the few that remain. So yeah, corporatism is taking over the country. It's you know, we were warned about corporations and by presidents going all the way back to 200 years, but we decided not to pay any attention.
And one other comment, I do think that the media's lack of coverage on this issue is largely because they are owned by huge corporations.
Right.
So they're also quite biased.
Yeah, they are. It was very unusual to see those three, the guy from BP, the guy from Transocean, the guy from Halliburton, at those hearings on Tuesday, attempting to toss each other under the bus. Usually corporate America won't do that. They don't turn on each other. They defend each other. So the mere fact that those three corporate heads, all involved, all their companies were involved in this catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico, the fact that they were turning on each other, shifting responsibility, blaming the other guy, I think is a clear indication that they understand that this is a monster catastrophe that has hit, and that when this thing finally plays out, the damage done is going to be just, I mean, we probably will not have the language to describe it, because something of this magnitude will never have happened before. We can't describe it using Katrina. We can't describe it using Hiroshima or Nagasaki or Western Europe after World War II. This is going to be an event. I'm beginning to suspect that it's going to be so calamitous that it is even now forcing these corporation heads to turn on each other and say, no, it's not me. It's not me. So I think we're in a world of hurt here, Charlie. I really do.
Well, Mike, we need you. And I can't imagine what we're going to do without you if you have to go off the air. So,
well, I can't either. Thanks, Charlie. I appreciate you checking in. And, you know, hopefully that's not going to happen. I don't mean to make it sound like we are on the verge of going off the air. I'm just, you know, trying to think a little bit long term here as we see our subscriber base continue to dwindle. And it's not because people aren't listening. Our listenership is going up. It has gone up dramatically since we started this program 14 months ago. But the subscriber base, the people who are willing to cough up $60 a year, that is diminishing. The people who are able or willing to spend $7.95 a month for what is offered to keep this program going. And, you know, I would hate to see this come to an end, but that's just the risk that we decided to take 14 months ago when we put our company together. we will take everything we had, which we did. We didn't borrow any money from anyone, but we took every dime we had, Kathy and me, and put this sucker together. And once it was clear that it was a viable idea, then we had two business partners step in to assist in organizing everything for us. They didn't put in any money, not at all. We didn't ask them to. So this is strictly our baby. And if it dies, you know, I'm not going to blame anybody. I'm just saying this is how we're structured, and this is what it's going to take to keep this going. And the key for us is about 5,000 subscribers. And if we can't do that, then we don't belong on the air. It's that simple. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.